I'm here today with Dr. Molly Carnes. The date is May 27th, 2004, and my name is Joyce Coleman, and we're going to be discussing her career at the UW. So I was wondering if you could start by talking a little bit about your childhood and early years, when and where were you born, and just a little bit about your early years of schooling.
So a little bit about my childhood?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Okay, well, kind of reminiscence therapy. I'm in geriatrics, so we would call this reminiscence therapy. I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, 1951, and my parents were both veterans of World War II. My dad had been in prison camp, and my mom was a WAVE, and it took them 5 years to have kids. Then they had my brother and myself, lickety-split, 18 months apart, and that's it, no more. And we lived Youngstown, Ohio, out kind of in the country. My dad was the Unitarian minister there. It was his first independent church. And we lived there 3 years. And when I was 3 years old, we moved to Memphis, Tennessee, where we also lived for 3 years in kind of a small, like, not projects, but what do they call it? Where all the house, subdivision, like where all the houses looked the same. And we were there 3 years. He was a minister in the church there, and my mother started a nursery school there because she had done a lot of work in education, and let's just say Ohio was ahead of Memphis. And then my father was becoming pretty active in the civil rights movement, and it was becoming not a very pleasant place to live if you were liberal and active in the civil rights movement. So we moved to Buffalo, New York, and when I was in first grade, and we moved in the middle of winter. So at winter break, I went from a pretty warm climate. We drove up to Buffalo. We hit about Erie, Pennsylvania, and I saw my first snowstorm. We were driving in a blizzard. And we arrived in Buffalo with everything covered with white. And I think everything stayed pretty much covered with white for the next 20 years. So, yeah, and then I lived in Buffalo. I remember coming in first grade. My brother was in second grade. I was in first grade, public school 30, which was right next door to the Unitarian Church. And I guess I had this very strong Southern accent because every time I would speak, people would talk about the way I spoke. So I stopped talking for a while. I mean, I wouldn't speak. But then I started talking again and never stopped. And then, because we were right next to the church, I used to go get my dad for lunch, and we would walk home together for lunch, because you took lunch at home then. Mm-hmm. And I remember we would walk along and sing, hi ho, it's off to work we go. And that was kind of fun.
So do you enjoy school?
Oh, did I enjoy school? Yes, I always enjoyed school. I did. And after first grade there was a lab school. I don't think my parents, you know, you never exactly knew what conversations went on, but I don't think my parents were too pleased with the public school education, but they were committed to public education. Mm-hmm. So they didn't really want to send me to private school, but they had just started a lab school with the teaching college there as a lab for the student teachers. And admission was by lottery, and the classes were small. The public school classes were very big, like 32 kids, and the it was called the campus school, and the classes were like 22 to 24. And I guess I was lucky, because first myself and then later my brother got picked in the lottery, and then I went to that school from second grade all the way through high school. I had some of the same kids graduating high school that I had in the second grade, that small class. And that was very nice, too, because it was lottery, a lot of the African-American kids, and in that day, really the only minority group was African-American. I do not remember any Hispanic kids, and I don't remember any Asian kids. The minority group was African-American. And the parents who wanted better education for their kids would, of course, try for this lottery.
Yeah.
So, I think when I graduated from high school, I would say probably a good third of our class was African American. And I didn't really think too much about that. But, you know, I had sleepovers at some of the black girls' houses. They had sleepovers at mine. So it was really very nice to have that kind of just subconscious exposure to a diverse environment
yeah.
that I think you don't think about
yeah.
if you don't have it. And you don't really think about if you do have it until you look back and think what a good thing that was for your life, for, mm-hmm. for my life anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So that worked out really well.
Okay. Now, did you take an interest in science early in life?
Well, I liked all parts of school. So I liked English, I liked math, I liked science. So I guess I would say I took an interest in it. I took an interest in the whole spectrum
okay.
of classes in school.
Okay. Now, who encouraged or discouraged your academic interests?
Well, both my parents were, it was the first generation to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And they both came from small towns in Indiana. My mother's family had been farmers, and my dad's parents, he had been a carpenter, and then he was a small town lay preacher.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Methodist minister. And they saw in their own lives how important education was. So I probably had it drummed into me from a very early age that there was mm-hmm. really nothing more important than education.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't remember ever getting a sermon on that. But it was just sort of clear that
okay.
there was, like, nothing better you could spend your time doing than going to school.
Okay. So it was always assumed that you would go on to university or college.
It was just assumed. I never would have thought otherwise.
Okay. Now, why did you choose the University of Michigan?
I was going to major in languages, and they had a huge spectrum of languages.
Mm-hmm.
And I also applied to Middlebury. And then when I visited Middlebury, it was definitely not me. It was very, kind of, everybody had like little t-shirts with alligators on them. And I visited the University of Michigan, and I fell in love with Ann Arbor. It was just like the whole city was a college, you know, like Madison. It was just wonderful. And then also I went there by myself, and I stayed with a former babysitter. And she was a TA, she had a class at her house, and she was having an affair with the professor, and the whole thing just seemed so wonderful and romantic. I wanted to be Wendy Crone. So, anyway, that's how I got there.
And what major did you choose and why?
Well, I was going to major in languages. I took Russian, and then I was going to major in anthropology, and then it was a very turbulent time.
Mm-hmm.
My freshman year, I never took my spring exams because they closed the school down because of the Black Action Movement.
Mm.
There were strikes, and it was a very turbulent time. So I came back my sophomore year, and I was kind of undirected. And I got the first C I ever got in my life. And I remember saying to my parents, this is just not healthy. I should drop out until I figure out what I want to do. Otherwise,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be able to do anything because I'm going to get bad grades. So they said, that's fine. We just want you to know that we won't pay for you while you're having your identity crisis. We'll only pay for you when you're in school. So I said, that's fair enough. So I dropped out and worked at a ski area in Colorado and followed some hippie down to North Carolina and worked as a waitress. At some sleazy truck stop. And it was a very good experience because I realized that as an unskilled woman, you had very few options. Mm-hmm. And, if you wait tables for 8 hours, you just have a pocket full of change and sore feet. But if you study for 8 hours, you're 8 hours smarter. So I said, I'm going back to school and whatever takes the longest. And it was medicine.
Really?
And actually, I went back and got a master's just a few years ago, so I would say I'm still in school.
Now, was the National Guard on campus when you were an undergraduate?
We didn't have the National Guard. That was at Ohio State, but we probably came close.
Okay.
Yeah, we didn't actually have people with guns, but I visited Ohio State during that time, and it was really scary. I went to Columbus, and there were people with... When I had dropped out of school, I kind of was hitchhiking and went through Columbus, and there were... guardsmen standing there with guns. It was really kind of scary. And then a friend of mine who was a year younger than I went to Kent State, and she was there during the Kent State disaster. That was the next year, I think. Yeah, that was the next year.
Okay. So then you finally graduated in 1973. That was your undergraduate, and you were planning to go on to do medicine?
I graduated in 74, right?
Okay.
And then I got into medical school, and so I just... stayed on my mother's farm with my boyfriend for like until I got my acceptance letters, and then I went to Buffalo. We had actually tried to get in the same school, and we didn't, because I wasn't a resident of Michigan. I was still a resident of New York, so I got into Buffalo, and I actually got into Creighton, and I got into Wayne State eventually late, but by that time I decided I'm just going home and live with Mom and Dad.
Now, how common was it for women to go to medical school at the time?
It was just on the increase. So the rapid rise began in the mid-70s, okay. So I was writing that. But if you look at the competitive times to get into medical school, that was still the most competitive time to get into medical school in terms of the required grade point mm-hmm. and MCATs. So it was quite competitive to get in. And I did not get in Michigan. And I was waitlisted at Wayne State, and I was actually waitlisted in Buffalo. Hmm. And probably the first lesson in how it's good to know people, I am sure that I only got in because my father was pretty well known as the minister of Buffalo. Hmm. And he was a good friend of an anatomy professor there named Opie Jones, who was a member of our church and whose wife had died, and my father had kind of done some bereavement counseling. And he was on the admissions committee, and I'm sure it must have helped.
Probably so. Now, were there a lot of women in your classes?
There actually were. Hmm. Buffalo was very progressive. 40% of my class were
really?
Women. So I didn't actually realize how rare it was till I came here as a resident. 40% of my class were women, and I think we had 14 African-American women because they doubled up on their minorities. So we actually had a lot more African-American women than we had minority males because they got double credit.
Okay.
Because they were women and they were minorities.
So this was part of a very deliberate policy then to increase the number of women and minorities?
New York was really quite progressive. Yeah, I think it was. But again, I didn't really notice it, you know, because I'd been to Michigan and I didn't really realize at that time how unusual that was.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of seemed like, you know, everything else I'd done. I mean, when I went to Michigan, they were probably trying an experiment. I didn't realize it was probably an experiment, but my roommate freshman year was black. So she was from Detroit, and we were roommates, and I didn't even realize that was odd.
Hmm. And a lot of other schools weren't doing that.
Yeah, that it was probably some kind of social experiment, and I was being watched, but I didn't realize that.
Hmm. Now, in what ways did your experience as a medical school inform your later interest in improving the gender climate in academic medicine?
I don't think that kicked in till later. Okay. I think I was pretty much oblivious, as a lot of young women are, to issues facing women. And then even when it was clear, when I look back now, you know, in hindsight, you know, some things were done that were clearly discriminatory. But, you know, you have to remember, I was raised in the 50s. I was born in 51. So I was socialized. I mean, I still believed, and I was told, I was taking a man's place in medical school.
Mm.
So, you know, I was coming from that. So when I rotated through surgery as a third-year student, and the head of the surgery clerkship said, well, I just want you to know, I don't believe women should be doctors.
Mm.
I mean, I didn't even realize that was a really terrible thing to say. I was thinking, well, you know, that guy's kind of an idiot. But I didn't realize, you know, in terms of, like, system-wide, what a
yeah.
terrible thing he was doing by saying that to me. It wasn't until later I thought, he really was an asshole. And the weird thing is, he was an alcoholic, and he smoked. He was a surgeon, and he had a tremor in his hands, and he had the gall to tell me he didn't think women should be physicians. You know, I mean, now I look at the whole thing, but at the time, you know, you sort of take this stuff. But I remember him saying to me, I knew the moment I walked into the OR what I wanted to do, and I said, so did I, because I knew I did not want to do surgery.
So these small incidents that you saw, you just sort of took them in stride. They didn't really bother you.
Yeah, I didn't really think much about them.
Now, you were a resident at UW-Madison from 1978 till 81. How did that go about?
How did that go?
Yeah, or how did that happen that you came here?
Oh, well, I met my husband in medical school. Dumped the boyfriend who was still in Ann Arbor. I fell in love with my husband-to-be, and we decided we wanted to go to res, but we li- both liked internal medicine. We wanted to go together. And we looked a number of places, but I had loved Ann Arbor so much, but I didn't want to go back. But I liked the idea of college towns. And it just happened, there had been the cohort a couple years before us had sent back these glowing letters of the University of Wisconsin about how much they loved it. And when we met with the dean, who kind of advises you on careers, he kind of looked at us, my husband has a real long braid, and he said, you know, you guys might like University of Wisconsin. And we had to look it up on a map. So then we came to interview here, and this couple who had come 2 years before us who loved it here, you know, took us into their home. They were really nice to us. And then we, you know, it was a beautiful September day. We saw the lake. We saw the boats. We're like, this is the place for us. We counted the number of night calls. There were fewer night calls here than any place else we were looking. And that was a time when they didn't have a match. If you were couples, you could get in early. I don't know if you know, there's a resident matching program. So you rank where you want to do your residency program, and then the programs rank you, and there's this one day where everything matches. And now they have a couples match. But at that time, if you were a couple, you could get an outside the match. So we applied outside the match, and we were accepted in October, which was fabulous, because everybody else had to wait till March. So that's why we came here.
Now, why had you chosen to specialize in internal medicine?
I loved it. I loved internal medicine. It seemed like in medical school, all the smartest people were internists. And it seemed like one that put everything together. So I loved the intellectual stimulation of it. I loved it. As soon as I did internal medicine, I knew that's what I wanted to be.
Now, at that time, were you interested in geriatrics, or did that interest come later?
Well, it came later, but I think it stemmed from the same thing. I loved medicine, and at the end of residency, I did not feel I was ready to go into practice. I wanted to do more training, and I liked research. I had carved out a research project during my residency, and I liked the whole academic milieu. So geriatrics was new, and I thought, well, and you know, it's odd, the same woman who we stayed with when we came here, she had done a she was doing a geriatrics fellowship. She was just finishing it. So she said, why don't you do geriatrics? It's a lot of fun. You get it, you know, it's sort of biopsychosocial. You do, it's medicine at its finest, plus it has all these social issues and economic issues and functional issues. And I'm like, okay. And there was almost no faculty in geriatrics. It was sort of, you know, building the residency from with or the fellowship from within. So I learned from nurses and social workers and speech pathologists. But as soon as I started doing it, I knew it was exactly what I wanted to do.
So you're saying it wasn't really a field yet? Was it just not considered?
Well, it was a field, but it was really new here. There was the director was actually a rheumatologist, and as long as we didn't bother him, he didn't bother us. So you really got, I sort of built it while I was doing it. And really had to become kind of a program builder early on. I remember as a fellow, I was writing grants already.
Now, you had a fellowship from 1981 to 83.
That was geriatrics.
Under Ned Kalin?
Oh, that was the neuroendocrine one. So I knew I liked at the academic milieu, and there was a Stettler fellowship. Pearl M. Stettler was a surgeon in like the early 1900s. She wanted to do academics, and no one would let her work in their lab. So she went into private practice. She saved this endowment, never married, and when she died, she set up this fund only for women physicians who wanted to go into academic medicine, and for some reason, only at Johns Hopkins, University of Wisconsin, and one other place, I forget. So I applied for this Stettler Fellowship, and I got that. That supported me for 2 years to do research. And then Ned was a new faculty. He's chair of psychiatry now, but he was interested in biological psychiatry. And kind of an interaction of stress hormones. And I was training side by side with the psychiatrist, so I became very interested in that area, too, and aging. There was a lot of stuff in neuroendocrine stuff about aging and stress. And so I did a two-year fellowship with Ned.
Now, 2 years later, you were appointed assistant professor in the Department of Medicine and in the geriatrics section. How did you go from being a fellow to an assistant professor?
Well, let's see. It was all grants, I guess. I wrote for a career development award through the VA. And Truthfully, I think they put me on tenure track because they thought they could just get rid of me that way. I mean, I would just burn myself out. I was bringing in my own salary. Mm-hmm. They didn't really have to commit much to me. There was lab space available. So I think they thought they would put me on tenure track, and then in 6 years, I'd be gone, and there would be no big investment because I was bringing in my own salary, and they had space for me. So it wasn't like a big deal for them.
Okay.
So, and I think I was really the only woman on tenure track then, but I didn't really think about it because I was surrounded by women. I was in geriatrics. I was working with nurses and social workers and speech pathologists and pharmacists. They were all women. So it wasn't really until I got tenure that I realized I was the only woman. And actually, I should say, there was a senior pulmonologist. She was the only tenured woman faculty member there. She was head of pulmonary, Helen Dickey. Mm-hmm. And she was really nice to me. She kind of took me under her wing a little bit. She was an old, gruff lady. I adored her. She invited me over to her house to have scotch. I didn't even drink scotch, but I drank it with her. And I went to a conference with her. She invited me. And
I think I've heard of her because her sister was Ruth
Dickey. Ruth Dickey, that's yes, right, because yeah. She does a Women in Science. So that was kind of nice. But I remember she was still alive when I was a fellow, and I'd run into her, and she'd say, "What are you doing geriatrics for?" And then I'd say, "Well, I really like it." And then she'd say, "What do you think you should do for hip pain?" You know, she started, it was kind of funny. But she died, and we had no tendered women for a while. And then I think I was the first married woman ever to get tenure in the Department of Medicine here, and certainly the first woman with children. And I was the only tenured woman for 5 years.
Now, what year did you get tenure?
1990.
You say that, were there single women who got tenure before you?
Helen. She was the only one. Helen, she was unmarried and single, so she was the only one.
Okay.
And then we had none for 5 years, and then there was me.
Do you think that was a controversial decision because of your gender, or did it matter at that point?
Well, I had good letters. I was funded. I had 2 grants. I had published like 24, 21 papers maybe. So, you know, that was a good amount. But I had people say to me, "Well, you know, you probably would have gotten tenure even if you weren't a woman." So it was clearly people were kind of giving me the impression that, you know, they needed to have a woman on tenure,
okay,
which I thought was kind of weird. But anyway, yeah, I actually had no problem getting tenure.
Okay. Now, when you did realize that you were the only woman with tenure, did that begin to bother you?
Well, it got my attention. But I think I was really jerked into the issues when I had been basically leading geriatrics.
Mm-hmm.
I was, now that I think back, it was kind of more complicated. There was a woman who had done a geriatric fellowship before me and had a grant from the NIH to try to develop geriatrics at the U. And she actually wasn't very friendly to me. When I came on fellowship, I just kind of thought we'd partner. And I remember I went and met with her, and she basically said, "This is my grant."
Hmm.
You know, basically she said, "I don't want anything to do with you." And I was like, okay. Because most of the grants at that time were coming in for the VA.
Mm-hmm.
So I just stayed at the VA.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot. We got an interdisciplinary team training grant from the VA. We got a hospital-based home care program. So even as a fellow, I was PIing these grants.
Okay.
But there was no real geriatric section at the U. She was kind of in with general internal medicine. And then they recruited Bill Urschler, who was a hematologist whose research was in aging.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought him in, and they made a geriatric section under him, which actually forced this woman to leave. I think they had, I wasn't really privy to it, but I think they kind of butted heads, and I think she left. And then it was so bizarre because suddenly he was my boss. I had actually given, when he first came, I was his boss.
Mm-hmm.
Because I gave him funds from a grant that I had written. The Geriatric Evaluation Unit came with FTE. And so I called him and said, "Do you want part of this FTE? Because I don't really need it, but it would be good for us because you have all this academic, you know, it would be good." Anyway, he said, "Yeah, great, fine." And then it allowed him to write for VA grants. So when he first came at the VA, I was his boss, and there was no geriatric section at the U.
Mm-hmm.
So he had, that was it. He was in hematology. So then they made him geriatrics head, and suddenly he was my boss. And suddenly, he was getting complete credit for all these grants that I had written when he wasn't even here. Mm. And I was like, well, that's a neat trick. And so that really did start to get my attention about issues related to women. And then I was like completely cut out of the loop. I had been involved in this group of academic leaders in geriatrics, or program directors in geriatrics at the national level. And as soon as he became section head, I was like no longer in that group. Mm. And so, you know, it just started to feel kind of wrong. I thought, well, that just doesn't seem fair. And then he started to give administrative stuff, leadership roles, to somebody who had been my fellow. I had directed the fellowship, wrote the grant to bring in the fellowship, train the fellows, and this one male who was a fellow who started working in his lab was suddenly being given all these leadership roles, and it just really felt wrong. I mean, it really pissed me off. So I didn't actually become active yet in it, but it certainly was getting my attention. I can tell you that. I was getting really irritated by it, and I went and looked up salary, and this fellow was making more than I was. And most of my fellows were women, and then I think, you know, as a woman, I know I'm rambling, but I'm thinking back on it. I think as a woman, it's harder to ask for stuff for yourself, but when you're, it brings out the maternal instincts when your trainees are not treated well.
Yeah.
So I didn't even think that probably a lot of the trainees were women because I was a woman, but I think that probably is true. So I had this one trainee in particular. She just actually recently got tenure because she stretched it out 75%. But I got a tenure track position for her, kind of negotiated for it. And she came on, and he had given her a 95% position with a lower salary than a guy who had just come on. And I noticed she kept being left out of things. Mm-hmm. So I had to go and fight for her to get a 100% position, and I kept inserting her in the dialogue that she was clearly being excluded from. So that, you know, got my attention too. So it was all kind of a slow roll. But I am not a person who likes to spend a lot of time in negative thought.
Mm-hmm.
So right around this time, women's health research was being seen by the National Institutes of Health as a way to bring more women into academic medicine.
Hmm, okay.
So I sort of had this aha. I'm a tenured professor, or I'm a tenured associate professor at that time, I guess, in academic medicine. Geriatrics is really largely women's health.
Yeah.
I'm in a position to actually build something in like older women's health on my own, where I don't have to bother with Bill Urschler, because I don't think he could even spell women's health. And it just was fortunate that I was on a study section at the NIH that reviewed all training grants.
Mm-hmm.
So I called the NIH and I said, you know, you really need to do all these training grants in women's health. They said, okay, fine, write them. So I did. I just started writing one after another. The first one I got was called a KO7, which was an academic leadership award, and I got it in women's health.
Mm-hmm.
So I got that funded, and it basically bought me out for 5 years to write more grants.
Okay.
And I just became a grant writing machine. I wrote for women's health, and Judy Leavitt was really helping me too. She was the associate dean of faculty, and she alerted me to the fact, for example, that they were writing proposals to insert things in the strategic plan of the medical school. She said, you need to write for women's health. I said, yes, I do. So I pulled together that one, and we got women's health inserted in the medical school strategic plan. And I had these old male professors saying to me, women's health, what is that all about? Little did they know. And so we got that.
When you say it was inserted into the strategic plan, what does that mean?
They did this strategic planning process. Any faculty member was invited to submit a proposal that addressed, I think it was like 4 or 5 questions. You know, is this area of research needed for the medical school to be, you know, top-tiered over the next 10 years? Does this address the teaching mission? Is this an important area of research? So I put all this stuff in for women's health.
So it's a way of setting the medical school's priorities then?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So, and they picked 6, and women's health was one of them. And aging was one of them, too, which was kind of neat because I was in aging. By that time, Bill Urschler had been kicked out. Yeah, he'd been kicked out by that time. I would say the best thing for my, there were 2 great things for my academic career. One, that Bill Urschler came, because he really did develop geriatrics. I'll give him his due. And 2, that he left. So that was, yeah, interesting. And I was, and then actually it was a very hard time professionally, because I had already sort of started in this direction of women's health. I got this Women's Health Fellowship funded. I had this Academic Leadership Award. And then I was like sucked back in to be acting director of geriatrics and the geriatric center at the VA. But it was good too, because it allowed me to sort of see, did I want to try to butt heads with the male leaders in geriatrics, or did I want to take this new direction? And the new direction was much more appealing.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of stayed with geriatrics until it was stabilized, and we recruited a couple fellows in to see the patients, and then I just tossed the ball to others and really focused my attention on women's health. But, well, it was, I don't know, my little stories, it was interesting. I became acting section head of geriatrics when Bill was kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to the section head meetings, I was the only woman section head. Got my attention again. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, there's no women. And I would hear everybody talk about physicians in the male gender. He. Researchers were he. So I just started talking about him as she. Didn't say anything. I just said, well, you know, gosh, in my section, it's a little different than that. And when the researchers do this, and then she does that, and I don't know when she does this. It was just a subtle thing. And at the end of the meeting where I did that, one of the senior professors in gastroenterology came. And I was known, too, because I'd been around a long time. Plus, my husband is talking on this stuff. I'll probably never stop. But anyway, this guy from GI came up to me and said, well, you made us look like fools. And all I did was just use she.
Really? So he was he being critical of you? No. Or was
he said,
acknowledging...
You know, he was acknowledging that they were really idiots, that they were not really thinking outside the box. And in this subtle way, I had shown them...
That's interesting.
...that their assumptions that both physicians and researchers were men...
At later meetings, did they start using both genders?
Are you kidding? No, but I think that, actually I shouldn't say that. I think they did become more mindful of it. I did hear a lot more he, she's, him or her. It's true, I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And all these events that you're describing, this is the early 90s?
No, it would be mid-90s by that time, I think.
Okay.
Probably, because I got that women's health thing, because I struggled with Bill for a while. It was not pleasant, and you feel it, but you can't actually articulate it. I guess that's why they call it the glass and the glass ceiling. But it just seemed, I've always had a strong sense of fairness, justice, and it just seemed unfair to me, you know, that a fellow would be promoted beyond me, that a fellow would be making more, that I would be left out of these decisions when I was clearly senior to this guy who had been one of my fellows, and I could just see, you know, the dynamic. I just did not feel right. So that took about 5 years probably, because I think I was going up for professor by the time I got this NIH grant.
Okay.
But I had reviewed the first time around, the VA started funding women's health fellowships, and I was in the review group the first time around. And I remember coming back and saying, we could do this. And I pulled together that. So I can't remember the exact sequence of things, but a lot of stuff began to kind of coalesce around women's health at the same time. Actually, even before Bill had to leave. I would have gone in this women's health direction, you know, and he could have stayed in geriatrics and things would have been fine, but I had to do all that leadership stuff in geriatrics. I actually remember now delaying the start of my leadership award because I had to do all that administrative stuff in geriatrics.
Okay.
But, you know, when he left, that was really ugly. I don't know if you know that history, but he had been having sex with two students who were in his lab, and he broke university policy, and then it turned out he was downloading pornography at work. He was, like, addicted to pornography, and it was really ugly. And then he was recruited to Norfolk, and he took, like, half the division with him.
Oh.
In fact, we would joke, Norfolk again, we'd say. So he took the section secretary, he took... Two of the junior faculty, this guy that was being promoted above me, he took him, took one of the fellows who was going to stay here. It was really very difficult.
Okay. Now, I was going to ask you a little bit about your research. Could you talk a little bit about the research you did in geriatrics before you switched directions?
Yeah, it was really kind of schizophrenic because, in fact, I think people at the NIH probably thought there were two Molly Carneses. My research actually had nothing to do with aging. It grew out of the work I had started with Ned Kalin,
mm-hmm.
and Mark Brownfield in the School of Veterinary Medicine. I worked in his lab for quite a while. Looking at pulsatile ACTH, looking at the rhythm that ACTH, which is a stress hormone made by the pituitary, is secreted. So my lab was the first lab to describe high frequency rhythms of ACTH in a rat model. And then I did a little work in humans too, but not much. It was mostly rat. I was known for rat research. And then I struggled to keep my lab funded. And that was kind of a painful time too, because I could not keep that research funded. But in retrospect, that was the best thing that happened, because if I had been able to keep that funded, I probably would have headed down there. But because I couldn't get that funded, I again had to sort of look around for what direction I could take. Mm-hmm. And that was all kind of happening around, like, the women's issues, women's health being promoted as a way to bring more women into academic medicine, my view of what I could do in terms of grants from the NIH work. So it just kind of all came together, and it just crystallized as a vision that I would close my lab and move in this new direction. And I wrote into the NIH grant that I would go back to school and get a master's in epidemiology to sort of study the issue of women in academic medicine, what kills them, basically. You know, what takes 40 to 50% women in medical school and kills them down to no tenured women.
Okay.
Looking at risk factors, you know, sort of from an epidemiologic disease perspective.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. So I got a degree in epidemiology.
Well, I'm really interested to hear you say that the focus was on women's health, was to bring women into academic medicine, rather than feeling like women's health had been neglecting and that there were certain diseases that hadn't been adequately studied. I mean, was that a concern also?
Well, that was always a concern, but I was actually much more drawn to the leadership aspect, because every time there was any advance in women's health, it was almost directly related to a woman leader in academic medicine. So I basically saw that the women's health stuff would continue to fix itself if you got more women leaders in academic medicine.
Okay.
And actually, I mean, if you look even in, certainly in remote history, that was true. You're a historian. So there were those, like, physiologic societies around the Civil War that got rid of the corsets, you know, and you know, the birth control clinics, Margaret Sanger. I mean, women's health was always promoted by women leaders. And in more recent history, it was a group of academic women physicians who approached the Congressional Caucus on Women's Issues, Olympia Snow, Pat Schroeder, and got them to then go to the government accounting office and get it to review the NIH budget for how it was spending money on clinical research by gender. Mm. And that report came out in 89 and hit the news big time.
Okay.
You know, the NIH is not spending more than like 9% of its budget on research for women's health. And actually, it was out of that that the Office of Research on Women's Health at the NIH was established by congressional mandate.
Okay.
So, I mean, I just saw the issues as so linked, but it was the leadership issue that much more appealed to me in terms of developing women's health, because I saw what I was doing was basically women's health anyway. Geriatric, I mean, walk through a nursing home.
Yeah.
But it was so interesting, because I found, people said, what kind of physician was I, or what did I do? If I said, I'm a geriatrician interested in older women, their eyes would sort of glaze over. If I said, I'm an older women's health physician, or I'm a physician interested in older women's health, if I left out the geriatrics piece, they said, really? They would get so much more interested. So it was really just a bias against aging, I think.
A feeling that geriatrics was for...
Geriatrics, yeah.
They would die anyway, okay.
Right, so it was interesting that the end result was the same. I was interested in older women, older women's health. But if I started off saying I was a geriatrician interested in older women's health, people were a lot less interested than I just said I'm a physician interested in older women's health, or I'm an internist interested in older women's health.
Okay.
Isn't that interesting?
That is really interesting. And so you're saying that the 1989 report was saying that older women's health, among other women's issues, had not adequately been studied.
Well, it was saying women's health. And actually, as a geriatrician, I also was interested in older women's health. I mean, the leadership thing did interest me, of course. But I also looked at the national dialogue, and it was clear to me the older woman was being left out of this whole women's health movement.
Okay.
So it was directed at, like, midlife women. In fact, you would see some of the dialogue was like, your mother, when your mother is aging. And I'm like, whoa, 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 what about the aging woman?
Okay.
So, because it was largely like gynecologists initially that were kind of pushing it. So
breast cancer, maybe?
Breast cancer advocates certainly had their thing, too. It was a lot about midlife women.
Okay.
Or younger reproductive age women. And so that did get me, too, I thought. As a geriatrician, for the women's health perspective, I have something to add. And then there's this ability to bring women leaders in through women's health. A women's health research venue.
Okay.
So it's kind of the two things together.
Okay. So in the 90s, you're interested in starting to bring women into academic medicine. What are you doing?
I just wrote grants. So I started off thinking, how do you get people interested in women's health? First of all, it was clear to me, if you put women on something, men do not come. So I had a women's health fellowship that I got through the VA. I don't think I've ever had a male applicant for that thing.
Really?
Yeah. Because, and if we had a women's health seminar, women's health anything, men do not come. They self-select away. So I use that to our advantage. So I had that fellowship through the VA, and then I realized that in fact, I presented a poster on this, it only funded 2 years, which is not enough to develop an academic career. You need far more years than just two.
Mm-hmm.
So I just marched along. I went into the NIA again, aging again, and got an institutional training grant. They're called T32s, which funded 4 slots. It took me 2 times to get it, but I got it. And that funded PhDs and MDs to do research in older women's health. And I pulled together for that grant about 25 faculty who were all NIH-funded, doing research, a lot of them in aging, for my aging network, but it was women's health. I just, you know, sort of crafted it as older women's health,
mm-hmm.
and got that grant. And then I just marched ahead and got the next level grant, which is called a K-12, which funds women or funds trainees, but it was all women, at a higher level. And then I was starting to become more interested in diversity among women, because
mm-hmm.
I saw white women were kind of the first minority entering this male hegemony,
mm-hmm.
and that it would be just a crying shame if we didn't enter as a diversified minority,
mm-hmm.
because certainly historically white women's issues and minority women's issues have been split largely by, I think, the political regime. But so since we had seen that we could use, it was clear people wanted to study something in a personal connection to.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the reasons women weren't as interested in bench research, because they couldn't see a direct relation. Plus the labs are still more sort of male dominated.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw that we could strategically use a theme of women's health research to draw more women. And, you know, the Institute on Medicine, other people were kind of recommending, or it was clear to me that, I don't know if they were specifically recommending it, but what was happening was that you could use themes of health disparities to draw more minorities. So I mm-hmm. thought, well, why not use health differences among populations of mm-hmm. women as a way to bring more women? And I have to credit Diane Lawver in the School of Nursing for also making me realize this. Because when I was first sort of doing a needs assessment of what was going on in women's health around campus, I mean, after all, I was more in aging than women's health when I first started. So I went to all the people who were doing women's health, and she had been, you know, in women's health research in the School of Nursing for years.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the first one. She said, look what's coming. You know, look at it. Special populations. That was a term that was been using then. And she showed me in some of her books that she had from NIH, from a conference and things, you know, this is what we should be thinking about, differences mm-hmm. among women. And that kind of got me thinking. So anyway, featuring those two issues, women's health research, older women's health research, because it was aging, and diversity among women to help recruit women in a pipeline. And so I have 10 trainees a year now. And right now I have 3 African-American women, 1 woman from Pakistan, which isn't an underrepresented minority, but it's still a minority. And it's too early to tell full success, but of those who I have supported at some point, who are farthest along, I have 2 women on tenure track, one in University of Rochester, one here, and actually Judy Houck in history was on our training grant, so I guess
really?
I have 3, yep, I have 3 if you count her on tenure track, And then Jane Mahoney, who was a trainee as a geriatrics fellow, not on one of my women's health grants, just got tenure this year. So I would say it looks like it's working.
Okay.
Got more women, and I don't have any minority women yet on tenure track, but I do have several postdocs, so, I mean, it looks like it's working.
Okay, and just to clarify, these positions aren't restricted to women. They're just designed to appeal to women in particular.
Yeah. I've never had a man apply.
But men could apply.
They could apply.
Okay. Right.
And then we got that cluster hire. I went for one of those cluster hire programs. That's what hired Judy Houck, actually. And I worked with Linda Schuler in the vet school. And we submitted our proposal for biology of sex and gender differences, and we asked for three positions, and we got them. And I would say 97% of the people who applied were women. Hmm. And we hired three women, all on tenure track, in different departments doing different research.
Hmm. Now, can you talk about the teaching and mentoring that you've done? Does that overlap with what you were just talking about, or is there separate teaching and mentoring?
Well, I think it's all integrated. I mean, I don't have a lab now, and my research is really studying how to increase the diversity of academic medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So I see it all as woven in. You know, my research outcomes will be whether these women get tenure and are happy in, you know, flourishing academic careers.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll skip over the section here and move on to the section on the gender climate in the medical school. So I was just wondering if you could talk historically about some of the ways in which women and men have been treated differently and how that's changed over time. Why is it that so few women have pursued academic careers in medicine?
Well, I think they're discouraged in many ways. One of the most powerful ways is that they do not see any women in academic medicine.
Mm-hmm.
They see more in the basic sciences now than ever before, because we have increased the number of women in the basic science departments, and early on in medical school, that's who they see, because mm-hmm. the first 2 years are largely taught by basic scientists. But they're training to be physicians, and they do not see women tenured physicians. I don't see the medical students. Well, every year I have them over to my house once, so I see a lot, whoever comes I see. I think there were 40 last time. So they see me once, but mm-hmm. I don't intersect with medical students in any other way.
So there are a lot of women doctors out there, but they're just not choosing to pursue academic careers.
Right. Okay. They're almost all going into private practice.
Okay.
Which is good for the patients, but it's never going to get them in a place where they can actually transform the institution, where they mm-hmm. can help influence public policy, where they can help direct the, you know, where the research dollars go, where they can, you know, change the environment of academic medicine, which is caustic to both men and women. Mm. You know, only 50% of the internal medicine residency slots filled last year with U.S. grads. Mm. That's a symptom.
Mm.
Nobody wants to be like us.
Interesting. Why do you say it's a caustic atmosphere?
Because it is.
Long hours, bad
well,
working
yeah,
conditions?
Well, yeah, long hours and, you know, everybody, there's very little support, you know, not enough institutional support. The nurses are yelling at you, the hospital people are yelling at you. And if you don't have your own research career, where you're sort of CEO of like a mini business, it's not a real healthy environment. But a lot of it is just the hours. The hours are so long. And they have meetings at 6:45 in the morning. What are they thinking? This is like sick. And they're supposed to be promoting health. So, you know, I don't know. There's no simple solution. And I don't want to simplify things. But we need new perspectives to figure out the solution. Is it more doctors? Is it more physician extenders? I mean, what is it? But it cannot just continue to replicate the current model because it is not working.
Okay.
They need women in academic medicine.
Okay. So it's working for neither men nor women.
Right.
But it seems to be scaring away more women than men.
Well, and that's always true. If you have an unhealthy environment, the newcomers are always disadvantaged the most.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be women and minorities. And they're also more vulnerable for other reasons because, and this is what we're studying with Wisely. I wonder if I have one of my brochures to give you.
there's a lot of research from the social sciences showing that unconscious biases work against you if you're a woman or an underrepresented minority in terms of evaluation of your work, evaluation of your paper. You know, if you send, I guess I've given them all away, but if you send the same CV around and you put a male or a female name on it, it will get evaluated differently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I've given them all away. But we've made these brochures that try to educate people about the influence of unconscious biases on evaluation. But anyway, there's things working against women that are just beyond just their biology.
Okay, okay. Now, what has the medical school been trying to do to remedy this situation?
Well, I think there's some frustration. I don't know this for sure. I see just almost on a weekly basis missed opportunities that could be used to help advance women. But I think there's some frustration because we did a gender climate survey that I paid for off my leadership award from NIH. Sharon Foster from Pediatrics took a lead role. Julie McMurray, Judy Levitt, Mark Linzer was involved. It was a good group. It was a fun group to work with. And we adapted a tool from Hopkins, and we surveyed all the faculty at like a 63% response rate. And we showed that the climate, the professional working environment, the climate, whatever you want to call it, for women is much worse in the medical school than it is for men. And we approached the dean and we said, and the AAMC, the Association of Academic Medical Colleges, made also at that time recommendations for how to improve things for women. And we went to the dean and we said, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this. And he actually did almost all those things. Judy Levitt was pushing him on it. She was fabulous in that mm-hmm. role as associate dean. So he started a breakfast network for women faculty every month, and he hired an ombudsperson, and he sent two women every year to the AAMC meeting. And I think, naively, he thought, and we thought, that would solve it.
Mm.
Check. So, you know, 3 to 5 years into it, we see almost no progress, particularly with the MDs, and, you know, we realize now that we have studied it and understand it in more depth, that it's much more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what is the medical school doing to fix it? Not much.
So really. It's not doing enough, but it's also not clear what it could do. It's not that there are three things it could do and that would fix everything.
Oh, no. They try. I mean, we've done all the things that you might think, if you didn't understand the root causes of this, if you didn't understand how the embedded historical status differential between men and women, how much that impacts things mm-hmm. in all of us, in men and women. All these studies that look at the evaluation of men's and women's work show that it doesn't matter what the gender of the evaluator mm-hmm. is. We, as women, evaluate women's work mm-hmm. lower.
Yeah, that sounds like Virginia Vallian's work.
It is. Virginia Vallian. Well, she's drawn it together. She isn't actually the primary researcher, but she has pulled it together.
Yeah.
So anyway, now that we understand it, we realize that none of these things will work. But a lot of people who haven't studied it think, well, if you just have, you know, a year extension of tenure clock for childbirth, that'll do it. Or if you just have prorated tenure clocks so that people can go 75%, that'll work. We've got all those. That doesn't work. I mean, I'm sure it's good,
mm-hmm.
but it you have to really educate people to realize that we all have gender biases and ethnic racial biases,
mm-hmm.
and that as these play out on a day-to-day basis, they influence our behavior toward these groups and our evaluation of their work,
mm.
and even if it's only a small positive bias for white men, there have been several studies that have done computer modeling that show even a 1% positive bias at the end of the day causes more men to be on top and more women to be on the bottom.
Okay. Okay. So to a certain extent, it's people just getting frustrated with day after day, very small comments, small biases, very small things, but they all add up to people feeling dissatisfied and choosing to leave.
Right. And women themselves, like here's a study. Lori Bakken, who's an assistant professor in on tenure track in our department of medicine, but she's a PhD educator. she is turning her education scholarship toward this issue of training. How do we train clinical investigators? How do we train physicians to be researchers? And she's very interested in gender differences. Mm-hmm. And we've collaborated because our interests really intersect here. So she took 57 male and female physicians, about the same number of each, and she did like a self-efficacy assessment on 30 different learning objectives for what's necessary to be a clinical researcher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, self-efficacy, self-perceived competence.
Yep.
And she found that women, for the same level of training, had a lot less self-efficacy, a lot less self-perceived competence than did men.
Mm-hmm.
It's only significant on like one or two, but it was less. Then following a 3-day intensive workshop on how to be a clinical investigator, she repeated this
mm-hmm.
and found that the gender difference was exaggerated. Women were lower than men on all 35 variables except one, where they were not significant, but a tiny bit higher, which was use of the English language. And they were significantly lower on 7 of the variables.
So this is women's perceptions of their abilities. This is not an objective measurement of their abilities at all.
Right. But it is self-efficacy that predicts career persistence.
Mm.
So even if the women were actually right, after they saw this whole 3-day workshop on clinical investigation, maybe their assessments were realistic. They said, wow, clinical research is, you know, more complicated than I thought. I'm going to have to take more training. I'm going to have to do that. Maybe theirs is accurate and the men's is like way off. It doesn't matter.
Mm.
If the men think they're going to succeed more readily, they will.
Mm.
So, you know, nobody has addressed that.
Yeah.
That our current traditional methods of pedagogy to train physician researchers is advantaging men more than women.
Although that seems to be a systemic problem, because you know, all through sitting in many undergraduate classes, you'll find male students feel more free to speak up, ask questions than the female students. So it seems to be something throughout the entire education system.
Well, it probably is, and there has been work on self-efficacy in education at other levels, but hers is the first work to look at this in physicians training to be researchers.
Okay.
But you're right, there's a lot looking at men and women in math. There's a lot of stuff that's been done related to education and gender differences.
So it's a massive problem that can't be solved easily.
Massive problem that can't be solved easily. But we're hoping research and education will help.
So what are the future goals? What are the things you think the medical school is planning to do in the future to address this problem? Is it planning any new things?
Well, I don't know, Joyce. I don't think our deans get it. I mean, it's taken me a year to get a raise myself. I mean, not to personalize everything, but I think I'm probably one of the most prominent women in the medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And it has taken me a year to get a raise. I have brought in data showing that I'm 2 standard deviations below men with comparable, you know, position mm-hmm. descriptions and comparable. And in the last meeting I had, where I was trying to show these data, you know, the dean came forward with a proposal for a raise, and I said, but that's not fair. That's, you know, not, doesn't put me at the level of the men. He looked at me and said, I have no gender bias. That's lethal.
Hmm.
We all have gender bias. I have gender bias. You have gender bias.
Mm-hmm.
It's the people who say they don't have it that are the most lethal.
Yeah.
So the fact that the dean, when I see on a day-to-day basis, the dean's office acting in a way that clearly shows there's systematic, institutional, system-wide gender bias, when I see that happening and I see a dean saying, I have no gender bias, it makes me very pessimistic that we're going to move ahead unless we have a change of leadership.
Hmm. Okay.
I'm sure the leadership is good on a lot of things. I'm sure they're good on the Blue Cross Blue Shield stuff. I'm sure they're good on negotiating the Physicians Plus things. I'm sure they're good on building great buildings. But I do not see them with any insight or vision into how they're going to address the gender issue, nor the minority issue.
Okay. Now, is there an official position right now, somebody who's responsible for that? An associate dean or some position like that?
Well, there is this Faculty Equity and Diversity Committee that's chaired by Dr. Sarto That was actually fallow for several years after Judy Leavitt left.
Mm-hmm.
But Gloria is reinvigorating it, which is interesting. She's an emeritus faculty. I mean, there was gender bias, too. She had a CV that would, you know, just hugely impressive CV. And when we tried to recruit her here, the dean's office would only let her come if she came as an emeritus person. And now she's bringing in millions of dollars of grants. But, you know, and she doesn't, she's not embittered by this. But I watched this happen, and I think, you know, she should have been brought in as regular faculty. But anyway, so she's doing a lot of their dirty work. You know, if they can assign it to somebody else, they certainly won't take it on. Okay. And I think Sue Skoshelak, who's a goddess as far as I'm concerned, has, you know, whenever anything bad comes up, she's assigned to do the dirty work, and she does a great job of it. But I just don't see her getting the... She's the highest ranking woman ever in the medical school.
Mm-hmm. Her name is?
Sue Skoshelak. She's a senior associate dean for academic affairs.
Mm-hmm.
They should be kissing her feet. They treat her like dirt.
Mm. So generally speaking, you're pessimistic.
Well, I'm not a pessimistic person by nature. I'm actually very optimistic for the campus.
Mm-hmm.
John Wiley is an outstanding chancellor. We are so lucky to have him. He is fabulous. And I believe there is momentum on campus. Our NSF grant is in the College of Engineering, and Paul Piercy gets it for women. I think he's getting it for minorities too. He really gets it for women. And College of Engineering has committed big time to both women and diversity issues. They have the model for diversity programs for campus. We're trying to replicate it with some of these grants for other units on campus. And since Wisely has been there, they now have like 5 women in electrical engineering, where they had 1 for years.
Mm-hmm.
The percent of women who accept hires has gone from 40% to 90%.
Wow.
So I am very optimistic for certain selected areas. And I think, you know, the provost has been charged with this, and I think he's committed. And I think, you know, the hiring of Bernice Durand as the Associate Vice Chancellor for Climate and Diversity, and the initiatives that are coming out as partnerships between the provost office and Wisely, I have a lot of optimism for that. The medical school has, I don't know who's going to see this, but I really think the medical school is not going to move ahead until we have a change in leadership.
Hmm. Okay.
I just cannot see it.
Okay.
Just that, I don't know who that goes to.
Well, you mentioned Wisely, so maybe now it's a good time to talk about Wisely. I was wondering if you could talk about how you and Joe Handelsman established Wisely at UW.
Oh, that was so much fun. Well, I had been interested in these issues for quite a while by this time. And I was chairing the Women Faculty Mentor Program, and Joe had done a lot on women's issues.
Okay, we're back with tape 2.
Okay, so you were asking me how Joe and I started Wisely. So I was saying we had both taken on leadership roles in the campus for women's issues. And then this RFP came out from NSF.
RFP means?
Request for Proposals.
Okay.
For these, they were called advance grants.
Okay.
And it was, they were institutional transformation awards, $3.75 million over 5 years to increase the advancement and participation of women in science, in academic science and engineering, particularly at a leadership faculty level. So it was like just what we had, it was wonderful. So I think about 10 people sent me that RFP, and I think probably 10 sent it to Joe. So I called NSF, which does not usually fund physicians.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to the project officer, program officer, I guess they're called, and I said, you know, I'm a physician, but I'm very interested in these issues, and I've been doing campus-wide stuff, you know, basically, do I have a prayer if I go in for this? She was very helpful. She said, well, don't run it through the med school, and emphasize your campus-wide stuff. Don't emphasize anything you've done in the med school.
Okay.
And then Joe was actually going to go, there were several programs under advanced. She was going to go for the leadership award, but we wrote in and said, well, can we go for both a leadership award and the institutional transformation award? And the program officer said, well, why don't you just blend them together.
Mm-hmm.
So then it was like an aha. We decided we would be co-PIs. And that was so much fun writing the grant with Joe. Because we have different styles and different perspectives, but it was really fun to work with another woman, you know, at that, with that academic fervor.
Mm-hmm.
Because mostly I had been mentoring people below me. Although when Gloria came, I had that same kind of charge, Gloria Sarto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, to work with another senior woman and just have, you know, ideas bounce around, was just fabulous. So Joe and I wrote this grant that basically proposed to do everything. It was very ambitious. And we got it. Was the number one rated grant in the review.
Wow, and I've written down that there were 76 applicants.
Mm-hmm. And they funded...
Nine?
They funded nine, right.
And what year was that, roughly?
Well, we're in our third year, so what would that be, 02?
Okay.
Oh, one. I guess it started in 01, right?
Okay. Okay, now what is the mission of Wisely?
It is to increase the participation and advancement of women in academic science and engineering, and to not just do it, but to study the mechanisms you're using to do it.
Okay.
So both implement and then study and evaluate mechanisms to make it possible. And that's what we're doing. We're hitting it from all sides. We've got, you know, seminars to bring women together. We interviewed senior women in science and engineering. We did a random sample of 40 women faculty and staff, and then developed this survey that did all faculty in partnership with the provost office. We're doing training sessions for search committee chairs based on some of that stuff I told you about, mm-hmm. teaching them about evaluation and mm-hmm. biases. Joe is leading a whole initiative to train chairs of departments about campus climate and survey their own units,
mm-hmm.
feeding back to them what the climate is in their unit. I mean, we're just hitting it from all sides.
And how do you pick those priorities?
Well, we had them in the grant.
Mm-hmm.
And then we knew we couldn't do them all the first year. So what we did was hold town hall meetings. We had two town hall meetings the first year where we invited everybody, but particularly women in science and engineering,
mm-hmm.
women faculty. And then we used those audience response devices.
Okay.
So you had immediate feedback, and we helped them prioritize us.
Mm-hmm.
So we had kind of question answers. They, you know, said, you know, which is this high priority, medium priority, low priority, and then they'd push it and we'd see it real time.
Wow.
So the ones they prioritized, we hit first. So one was a life cycle grant where we would actually pay for bridging research funding for men and, well, actually for women, and then we partnered with the grad school so they would fund men who had like a personal issue that prevented them from, that made their research careers vulnerable.
Okay.
So we funded...
It's more than pregnancy. That's more like...
Right.
That.
It could be pregnancy, but it was usually more because it was almost like Queen for a Day. I mean, some were just like so heartrending. We did have a lot that were pregnant or had babies or even twins, but those looked so pale by comparison to the people who were like single moms with kids with leukemia and they had just come down with a terminal illness. I mean, it was just like Queen for a Day. It was terrible. But the grad school also funded men, so that was kind of nice. Like we had a man who had bypass surgery and...
Okay, and these would be assistant faculty members, not yet with tenure.
Well, it could be either. The man was senior, but we were focusing, you know, we had kind of our internal priorities. So certainly those who would be vulnerable for not getting tenure they would be prioritized.
Okay.
So that was one thing we did. And that was viewed as a high priority by the women at the town hall meeting.
Hmm.
And then we had proposed to do like... a cluster hire for women in science and engineering. That was very low priority, and we kind of dropped that, actually.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of some of the other things we brought. Well, the survey was a pretty high priority.
So that was a survey in which you talked to 40 women to get their sense of mm-hmm. what the campus climate was like and how things
should change. Well, that built the survey. We used that to then build... We surveyed the whole campus.
I see, okay.
All faculty. We did biological and physical sciences, and then the provost kicked in for the humanities and social sciences. And then we also did selected titles of academic staff.
Okay.
So that was a big chunk. I think we have $80,000 in the grant committed to that survey.
Wow.
And then we're repeating the survey at the end of the grant.
Okay.
And so what we've done is we've taken data from that survey, and particularly we're focusing on climate, and we've gone around to the individual... schools and met with their department chairs, because every school has like a meeting where they get all the chairs together. We've
mm-hmm.
gone into that meeting and presented the data to them and
mm-hmm.
then pulled out the data for their own school to stimulate conversation
about,
and we've looked at gender differences in the responses to these climate questions, as well as minority versus majority faculty.
Okay, and what kind of response do you get from departments?
Well, the departments find it interesting, and there's different departments, or I mean schools, not departments, the different schools have kind of different personalities, so you know there might be a lot of conversation, there was a lot of conversation in education, less so in some of the other schools. But I think it gets them talking, and I think it also gets their attention because it's research. You know, it isn't just Bascom saying, this is the politically correct thing to do. This is a mandate you must do. Mm-hmm. It's faculty peers who are coming in and presenting it as research, which is something they value.
Yeah.
And I think that's been very good.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it credible, makes it, you know, it's not just a woman's issue. This is research. This is data. And then... in general, I would say overall, men and women, minority and majority faculty, overall are pretty satisfied. But the pattern of responses and some significant differences on some of the responses show that women in general and minority faculty in general are not experiencing as positive a professional climate as
okay.
are white men.
Okay. Are there particular aspects that you can point to where they...
Well, for the climate questions, we ask things like... I'm treated by respect by my colleagues, by the chair, by the students. I feel I am equal participant in decision-making in my department, the campus.
Mm-hmm.
I feel there's an equitable distribution of institutional resources.
Okay.
You know, things like that, that sort of got at that. And again, sometimes there were no difference. Sometimes there were just small differences that weren't significant. But whenever there was a significant difference, or whenever there was any difference, it was always women and minority faculty experiencing less of a positive
okay.
response to that. And we also pulled out the chairs.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that for a couple of reasons. Because when Joe leads these campus climate workshops for department chairs, it shows the chairs' responses are very different than the rest of the faculty.
In what way?
Well, they feel they were treated with much more respect.
Okay.
And, you know, things like, and when we asked, do you feel there's any gender differences or gender issues in your department? Or do you feel your department is supportive of, equally as supportive of women and male faculty? The chairs always tended to answer better than the rank and file faculty.
Interesting.
And same with minorities.
Okay.
So we did that to show the chairs that their perception may not be the same perception as the rest of the faculty.
Mm.
And then we also found in our interview with senior women that the chairs are viewed by the women faculty as having tremendous influence on the climate and did have influence on their own personal experience, some positive, some negative.
Okay.
So we thought that pulling the chairs out was two things. One, because you hear a lot of these chairs saying, oh, I don't have any power, I don't have any control, to show them, yes, they do. And two, that their perception is not necessarily that of the rest of the faculty.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So what are some of the upcoming projects that Wisely is going to be doing?
Well, we've got most of our initiatives up now, so a lot of it is continuing to do it. So I've only run one training session for search committees, so we want to, you know, get a lot more of those going.
No, would this be a mandatory? Is it something people?
Well,
would
nothing at UW is ever mandatory, you know.
Highly recommended.
It would be highly recommended.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, and that's just how to avoid biases when you're doing a search.
Well, we've couched it into doing a search. So it's sort of bait and switch. We bring them there as search committee training.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're a search committee chair. Don't you need training? And so, but we infuse the diversity stuff all the way through. So
okay.
You know, we've broken it down to, you know, elements of an effect, how to run an effective and efficient search committee, but then actively recruit a diverse and excellent pool of candidates, raise awareness of unconscious assumptions, ensure a fair, thorough review, develop and implement an effective interview process. So
okay.
It is the process of the search committee itself, but the gender stuff and the minority stuff
okay.
was infused all
okay.
the way through.
Okay. Now, what is the future of Wisely? It's a limited term grant? And what happens
yes.
what happens at the end of the grant?
Well, we would love to think the NSF would think we are so wonderful and so transformative of the institution that there would be a renewal. That would be marvelous.
And that is a possibility?
I don't think so, but I don't know. Anything is possible. Yeah, NSF is having a whole reshuffling of its administration, so I don't know what's going to happen. That would be nice. But we have kind of strategically built in things that could promote sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is clear to us that the university benefits from having a research entity to study these issues separate from Bascom.
Mm-hmm.
So the partnership between the two is effective, but Bascom can't do it alone because you just need that academic piece. You need graduate students working on it. You need to look at it as institutional research.
Mm-hmm.
And Bascom doesn't quite do that. You know, they're more programs. They're more like the government.
Okay.
But as a research entity, I think is a good way to go. So I think we've gotten people to see that. We became a center. We went through all the appropriate steps to actually get our own UDDS code. That means we can run grants through Wisely.
Okay.
And we already are running grants through Wisely. So the way this center stays afloat, the way any academic center stays afloat, is to recoup some of the indirect costs off federal grants.
Mm-hmm.
So right now we don't have enough. And I think at the end we may go to the chancellor's and provost's office and put in a proposal to keep some core funding for Wisely
mm-hmm.
for like 3 years to see if we can continue to keep ourselves funded, because my sense is there's a ton of workforce development initiatives coming down related to diversity.
Okay.
Particularly now that we have to increase the training of our domestic workforce because of 9/11. We're not bringing so many people in from abroad.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, it would be really short-sighted to do away with Wisely now. If we can keep ourselves going for a few more years, I think we'll be well positioned to bring in a lot of diversity grants. And in fact, we might sort of become the campus program that coordinates a lot of these diversity
mm-hmm.
academic grants, research grants. Again, we're not going to compete with the provost office. It's a collaboration, but ours would be the ones getting extramural funding, you know, doing this sort of research piece of that institutional investigation.
Okay. You talked a little bit about changes you've seen in the College of Engineering since Wisely was begun. Can you talk a little bit about what you think the impact of Wisely has been? What you think it could be in the future?
Well, you know, causation is a tough nut to crack.
Yes.
I'm an epidemiologist. You know, unless you have a randomized controlled trial, you cannot prove causation. So it may have happened anyway. But I have to say, the Dean of Engineering credits Wisely with some of the positive changes that have happened. And I would like to think that we have had a positive influence just by seeing more women. You know, the dean gave us space right next to the dean's office.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could not have been an easy decision because I'm not based in the College of Engineering. I'm in medicine, the medical school. Joe's in Cal's. So neither of us were based in engineering, and
mm-hmm.
he gave our program space next to the dean's office. So that signified, I think, a real sincere commitment. So there's more women walking around, for one thing.
Yeah.
You know, women come to interview for faculty positions. And I think it really kind of infused a sense of possibility among the few women faculty in engineering.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some ways they were feeling sort of oppressed. And I think this sort of visible commitment to women faculty was like, yes, maybe we can change things. So I would credit us for some of that, but, you know, it certainly not alone. I mean, the support of the dean's office really is very major, and the provost's office. You know, a lot of things just kind of coalesced.
Okay, so you see a particularly strong impact in engineering, but also on the wider university?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But definitely particularly in engineering.
Okay, and you say a larger proportion of women are now accepting offers from UW
mm-hmm.
than twice as many.
As did before. Those that are offered jobs, many more are accepting.
Which could suggest that Wisely, to some extent, made a more welcoming environment for them. That's something they might want to get involved with, or just knowing it's there.
Well, yeah, I think just having them know that it was viewed as important to promote the careers of women
mm-hmm.
in engineering. And I can relate to that just as a personal thing. When we got a chair, we have a great chair in the Department of Medicine. He's fabulous. And when he came in about 97, I think, after he was here about 3 months, he gave a State of the Department address, and he put up some PowerPoint slides, and he divided the faculty into gender and ethnic minorities, and he put it up, and he said, this is a problem. Yeah. I choked up. I knew it was a problem, but nobody was actually saying, mm-hmm. this is an issue we need to fix. And so I think, I can only imagine that women coming through here and interviewing are having that same kind of validation.
Yeah.
If they're in engineering, they know it's a problem. But to try to ignore it, to try, you know, to pretend it doesn't exist, somehow sends a negative message. So mm-hmm. to have the dean right up front saying, we know there's not enough women in engineering and we're trying to fix it. Come help us. Mm-hmm. I think that really is appealing.
Okay. My last question might be a little difficult. It's, what have you learned through your involvement with Wisely?
Oh, I have learned that anything is possible. Yeah. I guess that's what I've learned broadly. I've learned that it is... I have learned that this university is an unbelievably great place. When I was ensconced in the medical school, I knew we were great, but I didn't realize how great. And now that I see the whole breadth of the university, and I get a feel for, you know, the grandness of this graduate school and the insightful progressive leaders who lead this university and how their principles resonate with mine, that has been thrilling, because I like to work hard. And it's nice to know that I'm working hard for a system that is pulling in the same direction I am.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one final topic we're going to discuss is the UW National Center of Excellence in Women's Health. Could you talk about how in October of 1998, UW was selected to host the U.S. Public Health Service Office on Women's Health? Oh, it was chosen by the U.S. Public Health Service on Women's Health as a site for a National Center of Excellence in Women's Health.
Yep. It was, again, that whole just mad grant writing period. Anything that came up in women's health or women's health research, I was writing. So, let's see. I got that leadership award, I think probably 97. I was still acting head of geriatrics when when I first kind of started getting interested in women's health, Julia McMurray had been recruited, along with Mark Linzer, who was head of general internal medicine, and she was very interested in women's health, and I believe she was actually medical director of the women's health clinic at the U, the clinical piece, for a while. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, to credit UW hospitals, they really were visionary, and actually it was probably even Gordon Durzon who saw that women's health was going to be big, and our academic medical center started a clinic in women's health back in like 89, which was really very bold. And it was the fastest growing clinic since the day it opened its doors.
Really?
It's been in like three buildings since it started. But
so this was not a time when that was considered necessarily a priority by other institutions.
Oh, no. We were way ahead on that. So the clinical piece was growing. There was nothing that had really pulled together the academic piece, which was what I was sort of starting to do with this fellowship and you know, my goal to be able to bring more women into academic medicine. You had to kind of pull together the academic piece. And so I saw that a center would allow us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually, even before the RFP came out, we were having preliminary talks. I was meeting with nursing, pharmacy, because there was a lot of kind of incipient women's health stuff going on. Pharmacy was developing a course on women's health therapeutics, women's health and therapeutics. And as I said, nursing had for a long time taken the lead in women's health. They had a course in women's health. They had mm-hmm. joint appointments with Women's Studies. They had a graduate degree in women's health.
Really?
So the advanced master's in nursing, they have several. They have geriatrics, they have primary care, and they have women's health.
Hmm.
So they were really quite far ahead. So we were kind of having these initial discussions. And then the RFP, and we knew another RFP was coming, because the first one had come up before we were together at all. And then we kind of knew one was coming, and it came in May. end of May, it was due in July. We were already booked to go on a family vacation in Spain for 4 weeks. So I got this thing, and again, we had already started talking about a center, so there was already sort of momentum. I had had some meetings at my house. We called it the Stone Soup Group. After that Russian thing, nobody had any resources, but we thought if somebody gave a carrot and somebody gave a thermosuit, we'd have this ragu, you know. So then this RFP came, and I remember I got it, and I was like on the phone that evening. I was calling Sharon Foster, I was calling Julie Murray, I was calling Judy Stitt, who unfortunately died a year later, to say, we have to pull this together. And I said, I am willing to work on this 24 hours a day, but I'm leaving for Spain in 2 weeks. Uh-huh. And I'm going to need somebody to see it through. I tracked down Kit Allen, who also died last year. It's amazing how many of the early pioneers died. And Liz Carlin died. We've lost three of the early pioneers. But anyway, I tracked down Kit Allen and her diabetes meetings in her hotel room to tell her about this RFP and tell her, you know, I need her. She was PI of the Women's Health Initiative. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were meeting in my living room in the evenings. We were trying to work on this, but I was begging somebody to PI it. And Kit said she didn't think she could do it. And I begged Mark Blinzer. Mm-hmm. I said, Mark, I need you. I said, you know, I'll do everything I can, but this is good for women's health. It's good for your wife. And first he said no, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And then he and his wife, like, took a morning jog, and they stopped by my house, and I'm, of course, up working on the ground. And they knocked on the door, and I opened the door, and they said, we've just had a long talk. We'll do it.
Wow.
So I worked on it as much as I possibly could till I left for Spain. Steph, my administrative director, who has worked with me for years, I think she was my research program manager then, you know, worked closely with me, and then she continued to work with Mark. She was sort of the bridge, and she'd done a lot of grants. And anyway, he faxed me in Spain. It went in. And we made the final cut for that grant. By the time I came back in August, I think, we made the final cut. But there were a lot of gaps. I mean, we really were not mature enough. But, you know, the best thing was being runner-up. Mm-hmm. So they funded 6th, and we were 7th. Mm-hmm. But we figured there was going to be another RFP the next year.
Yeah, you were
so
ready.
So it was great. So then we had a whole year to meet in my living room.
Yeah.
And we had a whole year to talk to people about space. And so getting the reviews and saying, well, you know, we need space. So we got the space at Meritor. I mean, so so then when the next RFP came around, we were ready. I wasn't going to Spain. And we pulled it together, and we submitted it. And actually, it was a little more complicated than that. But we did get it. But I think I almost lost my job over it because we were putting it here. And actually, the CEO of the hospital at that time tried to step in and prevent us from putting in the revision. We made the final cut. All we had to do was address some questions, and mm-hmm. he tried to stop us from putting in the revision because we were going to be located at Meritor. And they were fighting over patients. And Meritor got before the university. The university told us they had no space. Meritor got before the university got that having a National Center of Excellence would actually help them get patients.
I see.
Which I didn't really care about. I was doing the academic piece, and I just needed space.
Yeah.
They gave us rent-free space and paid for our mailing and a lot of stuff. So.
But the university wanted this center then in its own space.
Well, suddenly. This was after the it was a contract, too, not a grant. We had a contract submitted on the table. All mm-hmm. I had to do was address certain things.
Yeah.
And I remember Gordon Durzon coming to my office with this diagram of the new Big West Clinic that opened several years ago. Mm-hmm. And I had a tiny office at the VA right then. And I remember it was 4 o'clock. He stayed like an hour in the office. And I really felt sort of threatened. That he threatened. He said, well, you know, I give resources to women faculty. I can take them away. He said, I give money to Ruth Benka. I could stop that right now.
Oh,
yeah, it was really nasty. And he wanted to force us to go out to Big West. Uh-huh. And I said, but, you know, one of the major things here is to develop a multidisciplinary research agenda. How the hell am I going to do that out of Big West? I don't want to do that. Plus, I live 2 blocks from here. You know, I don't want to drive out to Big West. So I knew I wasn't going to do that. And then this is one time when the fact that the university would not commit resources actually worked to my advantage, because I had no secretary in geriatrics. A student off my leadership award was keeping the whole section afloat. So nobody was bringing in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
So the dean actually sent me a letter telling me not to resubmit it, but I didn't get it because there was nobody delivering the mail. I did get a fax from Jeff Grossman telling me that they wanted to see the proposal, but they didn't say they wanted to see the proposal before it went out. Which I knew they really did.
Yes.
But I thought, you know, that's so absurd. They're not even academic. This is a grant, or this is a contract. So I sent it in, and then I got that letter from the dean. Actually, I did get that letter like the day it went out, saying that given how upset Gordon Derzan was, we could not move the center, which was fine with me because the only contract on the table had it at Meritor.
Okay.
I wasn't planning to move it.
Okay.
So Janet Greger told me later I could have lost my job for insubordination. But anyway, we submitted it. And of course, once we got it, it was a feather in everybody's cap.
Yeah. Yeah. So what does it mean to be a center of excellence?
Well, it actually doesn't mean a whole bunch. The money is just piddly. But it did sort of empower you, because most people don't realize how piddly the money is because they all think it's an NIH center. So it validated you as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true for all the women in the centers of excellence. And I've seen that nationally. And it brought us together so we could have a national dialogue across centers, which was very good.
Other centers also for women's health then?
Yeah, they're all national centers of excellence for women's health. There were 19 at the peak. I think there's 13 now.
Okay.
And then what it did locally was then give us the impetus to become a center, as I mentioned, getting our own UDDS code. So it gave us the core funding and the infrastructure to then go the next two or three hoops to get center status.
Okay.
So that my reporting line was to the dean. Otherwise, there's so many layers of hierarchy in academic medicine. I had to report to my acting section head, and then the chair, and then the dean. This way, I reported directly to the dean.
Okay.
Which is very good.
Okay.
Well, I don't think he really wants to hear from me that often, but I do report to him.
Well, what has the center accomplished in the past 5 years?
Well, we have trained probably 25 fellows or postdocs in women's health research. As mm-hmm. I mentioned, you know, we've got some on tenure track at various institutions. We have certainly made women's health visible. The last U.S. News and World Report ranked University of Wisconsin like 15th in women's health nationally. Mm. We would never have ranked otherwise. We are on the map in academic women's health. We are known. We have people talking at the NIH about what we're doing here in terms of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's been very good.
Okay. Now, to what extent is it focused on research or teaching or service or?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, the Public Health Service funded us, and I don't know, to do clinical care, but you had to have a thriving multidisciplinary clinical model in women's health to get funded.
Okay.
And that's where I do thank Gordon Derzan, because we basically got that said check, paid a small piece of salary for the person coordinating that clinic, and then just spent our whole time developing the research program.
Okay.
But the Office of Women's Health is not really a research program.
Okay.
Where it comes out of the DHHS. It's not NIH, and research isn't their big thing. It's much more kind of public health service kind of stuff. But Gloria Sarto, who I recruited pretty early, and I were right on the same page with that. And so we just charged ahead to develop the academic programs.
Okay. Okay. So the focus then has been mostly research.
Right. Absolutely.
Okay.
It's so long. But isn't it interesting how that happens when you talk about it and think about it, then you dream about it?
Absolutely. Now, in 1999, you wrote that one of the center's accomplishments was a review of the medical school curriculum for gender-specific content and cultural competence. Now, why was that review initiated?
Well, Sharon Foster, and it's interesting how many people who took an early lead in this area fell back or dropped out for one reason or another, or died. I mean, if you look at when we got the National Center of Excellence, I was the director, well, in the first go round, Mark Linzer and I were the co-directors, because Gloria wasn't on board, and mm-hmm. then he really had his plate too full, so he gallantly said, you know, I'd do it, I would serve if called, but I'd just as soon not. And so Gloria was there. So then when we got it, I was director, she was co-director. Then Sharon Foster in pediatrics, who had been very interested in trying to develop women's health curriculum in the medical school, was our curriculum director. Mm-hmm. And again, she had taken a lead role in authoring the gender climate survey and really saw it through to the manuscript completion. She was wonderful. So she developed curriculum, and there was a leadership core, which I think she was the titular director of, but Gloria and I had both done a lot in leadership, so that was probably a shared trio for leadership. There were five components. So curriculum, leadership, clinic, Julia McMurray, she wasn't. Julia was the evaluation director because she was very interested in evaluation. The clinical director was Julie Fagan, I think, who was the clinical director of women's health at that time. And then research director was Kit Allen. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. The clinical director was Judy Stitt. Oh, so two of our initial directors are dead.
Wow.
Yeah, Judy Stitt was the initial clinical director. She was wonderful. She was a radiation oncologist who had been squelched. Oh, I forget these things. Wow. She had developed a whole concept for an interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, comprehensive breast center. Mm-hmm. She had been trying to put it forward. Tim Kinsella was chair of her department, and I think he was threatened by her. I don't know all the internal politics. I didn't even know him very well. But she was made as creative and energetic and wonderful as she was. She had to drive like 3 days a week to Reidsville to do radiation oncology. She was sort of put off site. Mm-hmm. And I think she was quite frustrated. And so we brought her in. Again, it was empowering, you know, her energy, her vision. I'm telling you, those stone soup meetings in my house were so exciting because we could see the possibilities. And she could see that this might get her breast center going. And actually, her breast center is a reality now. Mm-hmm. Donna Sullenberger made it happen. But anyway, so she was the clinical director. And then and Kit Allen, who was the director of Women's Health Initiative, was the research director.
Okay.
So those were the initial people involved. And Sharon dropped out. Two of them are dead. And really, I think it's Gloria and me who remain.
I know.
I know. It's sad now that I think of it.
Well, I was asking about the medical school curriculum.
So Sharon took that on. Okay. That's why it was important.
Okay. Now, do you remember at all what the review found? I mean, what changes were necessary to make the curriculum more sensitive to issues of gender and ethnicity?
Well, there were a lot of gaps. As I say, she did a lot of work in this area, and it pretty much dropped when she had to step out to do more clinical work. I think she stepped out for family issues. Mm-hmm. But she found a lot of gaps, and I don't think they've been remedied, because I think the dean sort of thought we would take on all women's health in the curriculum, and I made it clear from the beginning, I was starting at fellowship and going up.
Okay.
With maybe, you know, a little bit in residency and internal medicine, but okay. Basically my focus was leadership.
Yeah.
So I think now Shobina Chadha, who was recruited out to the women's health clinical center, I think is doing some stuff in the medical school. But I don't think there's really been a systematic attempt since Sharon left to do anything in the medical school in the first 4 years related to women's health.
Okay, and what sorts of changes do you think are necessary? I mean, is this just more a focus, say, on looking at the male as a typical patient and forgetting about the female, or?
Well, it's both basic science and clinical. So Sharon found, for example, in the basic sciences, there was no attempt when discussing heart rhythms to note that potassium channels in women's hearts are much more sensitive to side effects of certain drugs that cause lethal arrhythmias than are potassium channels in male hearts.
Okay.
You know, so there's opportunities all along the line to talk about sex and gender. In physical diagnosis, to talk about what do you do when a woman has large breasts.
Okay.
You know, so these are not uncommon problems that will face the medical students, but there had been no systematic effort to think about them.
Okay.
Or the effects of anesthesia in men versus women.
Okay.
Or, you know, in women, women who are not pregnant, women who are pregnant and postmenopausal women, where there's great differences in, you know, pharmacokinetics of drugs and, you know, effects of all kinds of things. So anyway, there's no systematic attempt to address any of that.
Okay.
And I don't believe there still is.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know, but we have not been involved in any systematic effort to address it.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think I've reached the end of my questions. I guess I have my final question then would be just if you have any final comments about your career at the university to date or any of your hopes or plans for the future.
Well, I feel so fortunate that I wound up here. I told you how haphazard it was. You know, we liked the lake and we counted the number of on-call days. But I cannot imagine a place that would have accommodated my career in a way that UW has. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you can stay in one place and have multiple careers. You know, it's like I did geriatrics, now I'm doing women's health, I'm doing women in science engineering, and I just submitted this big NIH grant to help train clinical researchers. Because
mm-hmm.
I see that, again, as a way to bring in more women and minorities. But it's much broader than women's health. But my work in women's health had kind of positioned me to be kind of the obvious principal investigator for this grant. So mm-hmm. this would be enormous. It would be $15 million over 5 years. And that could be my next step. I don't know. But,
okay.
You know, UW, it's vast. You can do anything here.
So you've enjoyed your career here so far.
I have.
Well, thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome, Joyce. Thank you. It was fun.
I'm glad.